Recorded Books Romance presents an unabridged recording of On the Way to the Wedding by Julia Quinn, narrated by Simon Preble. This book is copyrighted 2006 by Julie Kotler Pottinger. This recording is copyrighted 2007 by Recorded Books, producer and publisher of Romantic Sounds, an imprint that features dramatic tales that will carry you away to exotic locales and sweep you off your feet. Unlike most men of his acquaintances, Gregory Bridgerton believes in true love, and he's convinced that when he finds the woman of his dreams, he'll know in an instant that she is the one. Oh, Mr. Bridgerton, if only things were that simple. And now, On the Way to the Wedding.
Prologue. London, not far from St. George's, Hanover Square, summer 1827. His lungs were on fire. Gregory Bridgerton was running. Through the streets of London, oblivious to the curious stares of onlookers, he was running. There was a strange, powerful rhythm to his movements. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. That pushed him along, propelling him forward even as his mind remained focused on one thing and one thing only. The church. He had to get to the church. He had to stop the wedding. How long had he been running? 1 minute? 5? He couldn't know, couldn't concentrate on anything but his destination. The church. He had to get to the church. It had started at 11. This thing, this ceremony, this thing that should never have happened. But she'd done it anyway, and he had to stop it. He had to stop her. He didn't know how, and he certainly didn't know why, but she was doing it, and it was wrong. She had to know that it was wrong. She was his. They belonged together. She knew that. God damn it all, she knew that. How long did a wedding ceremony take? 5 minutes? 10? 20? He'd never paid attention before, certainly never thought to check his watch at the beginning and end. Never thought he needed the information. Never thought it would matter this much. How long had he been running? 2 minutes? 10? He skidded around a corner and onto Regent Street, grunting something that was meant to take the place of excuse me, as he bumped into a respectably dressed gentleman, knocking his case to the ground. Normally Gregory would have stopped to aid the gentleman, bent to retrieve the case. But not today. Not this morning. Not now. The church. He had to get to the church. He could not think of anything else. He must not. He must... Damn! He skidded to a halt as a carriage cut in front of him, resting his hands on his thighs, not because he wanted to, but rather because his desperate body demanded it. He sucked in huge gulps of air, trying to relieve the screaming pressure in his chest, that horrible, burning, tearing feeling, as... The carriage moved past, and he was off again. He was close now. He could do it. It couldn't have been more than 5 minutes since he'd left the house. Maybe 6. It felt like 30, but it couldn't have been more than 7. He had to stop this. It was wrong. He had to stop it. He would stop it. He could see the church, off in the distance, its grey steeple rising into the bright blue sky. Someone had hung flowers from the lanterns. He couldn't tell what kind they were. Yellow and white. Yellow, mostly. They spilled forth with reckless abandon, bursting from the baskets. They looked celebratory, cheerful even, and it was all so wrong. This was not a cheerful day. It was not an event to be celebrated. And he would stop it. He slowed down, just enough so that he could run up the steps without falling on his face. And then he wrenched the door open, wide, wider, barely hearing the slam as it crashed into the outer wall. Maybe he should have paused for breath. Maybe he should have entered quietly, giving himself a moment to assess the situation, to gauge how far along they were. The church went silent. The priest stopped his drone, and every spine in every pew twisted until every face was turned to the back. To him. "Don't!" Gregory gasped, but he was so short of breath he could barely hear the word. "Don't!" he said louder this time, clutching the edge of the pews as he staggered forward. "Don't do it!" She said nothing. But he saw her. He saw her, her mouth open with shock. He saw her bouquet slip from her hands, and he knew, by God he knew, that she'd stopped breathing.
She looked so beautiful. Her golden hair seemed to catch the light, and it shone with a radiance that filled him with strength. He straightened, still breathing hard, but he could walk unassisted now, and he let go of the pew. "Don't do it," he said again, moving toward her with the stealthy grace of a man who knows what he wants, who knows what should be. Still, she didn't speak. No one did. It was strange that 300 of London's biggest busybodies gathered into one building, and no one could utter a word. No one could take his eyes off him as he walked down the aisle. "I love you," he said, right there, right in front of everyone. Who cared? He would not keep this a secret. He would not let her marry someone else without making sure all the world knew that she owned his heart. "I love you," he said again, and out of the corner of his eye, he could see his mother and sister seated primly in a pew, their mouths open with shock. He kept walking, down the aisle, each step more confident, more sure. "Don't do it," he said, stepping out of the aisle and into the apse. "Don't marry him."
"Gregory," she whispered, "why are you doing this?"
"I love you," he said, because it was the only thing to say. It was the only thing that mattered. Her eyes glistened, and he could see her breath catch in her throat. She looked up at the man she was trying to marry. His brows rose as he gave her a tiny one-shouldered shrug, as if to say, "It's your choice." Gregory sank to one knee. "Marry me," he said, his very soul in his words. "Marry me." He stopped breathing. The entire church stopped breathing. She brought her eyes to his. They were huge and clear, and everything he'd ever thought was good and kind and true. "Marry me," he whispered one last time. Her lips were trembling, but her voice was clear when she said, Chapter 1, in which our hero falls in love. 2 months earlier. Unlike most men of his acquaintance, Gregory Bridgerton believed in true love. He'd have to be a fool not to. Consider the following. His eldest brother, Anthony. His eldest sister, Daphne. His other two brothers, Benedict and Colin, not to mention his sisters, Eloise, Francesca, and, galling but true, Hyacinth. All of whom, were quite happily besotted with their spouses. For most men, such a state of affairs would produce nothing quite so much as bile. But for Gregory, who had been born with an uncommonly cheerful, if occasionally, according to his younger sister, annoying spirit, it simply meant that he had no choice but to believe the obvious. Love existed. It was not a wispy figment of the imagination, designed to keep the poets from complete starvation. It might not be something that one could see or smell or touch, but it was out there, and it was only a matter of time before he, too, found the woman of his dreams and settled down to be fruitful, multiply, and take on such baffling hobbies as papier-mâché and the collection of nutmeg graters. Although, if one wanted to put a fine point on it, which did seem rather precise for such an abstract sort of concept, his dreams didn't exactly include a woman. Well, not one with any specific and identifiable attributes. He didn't know anything about this woman of his, the one who was supposed to transform his life completely, turning him into a happy pillar of boredom and respectability. He didn't know if she would be short or tall, dark or fair. He'd like to think she would be intelligent and in possession of a fine sense of humour, but beyond that, how was he to know? She could be shy or outspoken. She might like to sing, or maybe not. Maybe she was a horsewoman, with a ruddy complexion, born of too much time out of doors. He didn't know. When it came to this woman, this impossible, wonderful, and currently non-existent woman, all he really knew was that when he found her, he'd know. He didn't know how he'd know, he just knew that he would. Something this momentous, this earth-shattering and life-altering. Well, really, it wasn't going to whisper its way into existence. It would come full and forceful, like the proverbial ton of bricks. The only question was, when? And in the meantime, he saw no reason not to have a fine time while he anticipated her arrival. One didn't need to behave like a monk while waiting for one's true love, after all. Gregory was, by all accounts, a fairly typical man about London, with a comfortable, although by no means extravagant, allowance, plenty of friends, and a level enough head to know when to quit a gaming table. He was considered a decent enough catch on the marriage mart, if not precisely the top selection. Fourth sons never did command a great deal of attention. And he was always in demand when the society matrons needed an eligible man to even up the numbers at dinner parties. Which did make his aforementioned allowance stretch a bit further. Always a benefit. Perhaps he ought to have had a bit more purpose in his life, some sort of direction, or even just a meaningful task to complete. But that could wait, couldn't it? Soon, he was sure, everything would come clear. He would know just what it was he wished to do, and whom he wished to do it with. And in the meantime, he'd not have a fine time. Not just at this moment, at least. To explain. Gregory was presently sitting in a leather chair, a rather accommodating one, not that that really had any bearing on the matter, other than the fact that the lack of discomfort was conducive to daydreaming, which in turn was conducive to not listening to his brother, who, it should be noted, was standing approximately 4 feet away, droning on about something or other, almost certainly involving some variation on the words duty and responsibility. Gregory wasn't really paying attention. He really did. Well, no, occasionally he did, but... Gregory! Gregory! He looked up, blinking. Antony's arms were crossed. Never a good sign. Antony was the Viscount Bridgerton, and had been for more than 20 years. And while he was, Gregory would be the first to insist, the very best of brothers, he would have made a rather fine feudal lord. "Begging your pardon for intruding upon your thoughts, such as they are," Antony said in a dry voice. "But have you perhaps, just perhaps, heard anything I've said?" "Diligence," Gregory parroted, nodding with what he deemed sufficient gravity. "Direction." "Indeed," Antony replied, and Gregory congratulated himself on what had clearly been an inspired performance. "It's well past time that you finally sought some direction in your life." "Of course," Gregory murmured, mostly because he'd missed supper and he was hungry, and he'd heard that his sister-in-law was serving light refreshments in the garden. Besides, it never made sense to argue with Antony. Never. "You must make a change. Choose a new course." "Indeed." Maybe there would be sandwiches. He could eat about 40 of those ridiculous little ones with the crusts cut off right then. "Gregory!" Antony's voice held that tone, the one that, while impossible to describe, was easy enough to recognize, and Gregory knew it was time to pay attention. "Right," he said, because truly it was remarkable how well a single syllable could delay a proper sentence. "I expect I'll join the clergy." That stopped Antony cold. Dead, frozen cold. Gregory paused to savour the moment. Too bad he had to become a bloody vicar to achieve it. "I beg your pardon," Antony finally murmured. "Oh, it's not as if I've many choices," Gregory said, and as the words emerged, he realised it was the first time he'd spoken them. It somehow made them more real, more permanent. "It's the military or the clergy," he continued, "and, well, it's got to be said, I'm a beastly bad shot." Antony didn't say anything. They all knew it was true. After a moment of awkward silence, Antony murmured, "There are swords." "Yes, but with my luck I'll be posted to the Sudan," Gregory shuddered. "Not to be overly fastidious, but really the heat. Would you want to go?" Antony demurred immediately. "No, of course not. And..." Gregory added, beginning to enjoy himself, "there is Mother." There was a pause. Then, "She pertains to the Sudan, how?"
Well, she wouldn't very well like my going. And then you must know, will be the one who must hold her hand every time she worries, or has some ghastly nightmare about...
Say no more, Anthony interrupted.
Gregory allowed himself an inner smile. It really wasn't fair to his mother, who it was only sporting to point out, had never once claimed to portend the future with anything so wispy as a dream. But she would hate his going to the Sudan, and Gregory would have to listen to her worry over it. And as Gregory didn't particularly wish to depart England's misty shores, the point was moot anyway.
Right, Anthony said. Right. I'm glad, then, that we have finally been able to have this conversation.
Gregory eyed the clock. Anthony cleared his throat, and when he spoke, there was an edge of impatience to his voice.
And that you are finally thinking toward your future.
Gregory felt something tighten at the back of his jaw.
I am but 26, he reminded him. Surely too young for such a repeated use of the word finally.
Anthony just arched a brow.
Shall I contact the Archbishop? See about finding you a parish?
Gregory's chest twisted into an unexpected coughing spasm.
No, he said when he was able. Not yet, at least.
One corner of Anthony's mouth moved, but not by much, and not by any stretch of the definition, into a smile.
You could marry, he said softly.
I could, Gregory agreed, and I shall. In fact, I plan to.
Really?
When I find the right woman.
And then, at Anthony's dubious expression, Gregory added,
Surely you, of all people, would recommend a match of love over convenience.
Anthony was rather famously besotted with his wife, who was in turn rather inexplicably besotted with him. Anthony was also rather famously devoted to his 7 younger siblings. So Gregory should not have felt such an unexpected wellspring of emotion when he softly said,
I wish you every happiness that I myself enjoy.
Gregory was saved from having to make a reply by the very loud rumbling of his stomach. He gave his brother a sheepish expression.
Sorry, I missed supper.
I know. We expected you earlier. Gregory avoided wincing. Just.
Kate was somewhat put out.
That was the worst. When Anthony was disappointed, that was one thing. But when he claimed that his wife had been somehow pained, well, that was when Gregory knew he was in trouble.
Got a late start from London, he mumbled.
It was the truth, but still no excuse for bad behaviour. He had been expected at the house party in time for supper, and he had not come through. He almost said, I shall nick it up to her, but at the last moment bit his tongue. Somehow that would make it worse, he knew, almost as if he was making light of his tardiness, assuming that he could smooth over any transgression with a smile and a glib comment, which he often could, but for some reason this time, he didn't want to. So instead he just said, I'm sorry, and he meant it too.
She's in the garden, Anthony said gruffly. I think she means to have dancing on the patio, if you can believe it.
Gregory could. It sounded exactly like his sister-in-law. She wasn't the sort to let any serendipitous moment pass her by, and with the weather so uncommonly fine, why not organize an impromptu dance al fresco?
See that you dance with whomever she wishes, Anthony said. Kate won't like any of the young ladies to feel left out.
Of course not, Gregory murmured.
I will join you in a quarter of an hour,
Anthony said, moving back to his desk, where several piles of paper awaited him.
I have a few items here yet to complete.
Gregory stood.
I shall pass that along to Kate.
And then, the interview quite clearly at its end, he left the room and headed out to the garden. It had been some time since he'd been to Aubrey Hall, the ancestral home of the Bridgertons. The family gathered here in Kent for Christmas, of course, but in truth, it wasn't home for Gregory, and never really had been. After his father had died, his mother had done the unconventional and uprooted her family, electing to spend most of the year in London. She had never said so, but Gregory had always suspected that the graceful old house held too many memories. As a result,
Gregory had always felt more at home in town than in the country. Bridgerton House in London was the home of his childhood, not Aubrey Hall. Still, he enjoyed his visits and was always game for bucolic pursuits such as riding and swimming, when the lake was warm enough to permit it. And strangely enough, he liked the change of pace. He liked the way the air felt quiet and clean after months in the city. And he liked the way he could leave it all behind when it grew too quiet and clean. The night's festivities were being held on the south lawn, or so he'd been told by the butler when he'd arrived earlier that evening. It seemed a good spot for an outdoor fete. Level ground, a view of the lake, and a large patio with plenty of seating for the less energetic. As he approached the long salon that opened to the outside, he could hear the low murmur of voices buzzing in through the French doors. He wasn't certain how many people his sister-in-law had invited for her house party, probably something between 20 and 30. Small enough to be intimate, but still large enough so that one could escape for some peace and quiet without leaving a gaping hole in the gathering. As Gregory passed through the salon, he took a deep breath, trying in part to determine what sort of food Kate had decided to serve. There wouldn't be much, of course. She would have already overstuffed her guests at supper. "The sweets," Gregory decided, smelling a hint of cinnamon as he reached the light grey stone of the patio. He let out a disappointed breath. He was starving, and a huge slab of meat sounded like heaven right then. But he was late, and it was nobody's fault but his own, and Anthony would have his head if he did not join the party immediately. So, cakes and biscuits, it would have to be. A warm breeze sifted across his skin as he stepped outside. It had been remarkably hot for May. Everyone was talking about it. It was the sort of weather that seemed to lift the mood, so surprisingly pleasant that one couldn't help but smile. And indeed, the guests milling about seemed to be in happy spirits. The low buzz of conversation was peppered with frequent rumbles and trills of laughter. Gregory looked around, both for the refreshments and for someone he knew, most preferably his sister-in-law Kate, whom propriety dictated he greet first. But as his eyes swept across the scene, instead, he saw her. Her. And he knew it. He knew that she was the one. He stood frozen, transfixed. The air didn't rush from his body. Rather, it seemed to slowly escape until there was nothing left, and he just stood there, hollow and aching for more. He couldn't see her face, not even her profile. There was just her back, just the breathtakingly perfect curve of her neck, one lock of blonde hair swirling against her shoulder. And all he could think was, "I am wrecked." For all other women, he was wrecked. This intensity, this fire, this overwhelming sense of rightness, he had never felt anything like it. Maybe it was silly, maybe it was mad. It was probably both those things, but he'd been waiting for this moment. For so long he'd been waiting, and suddenly it became clear why he hadn't joined the military or the clergy or taken his brother up on one of his frequent offers to manage a smaller Bridgerton estate. He'd been waiting. That's all it was. Hell, he hadn't even realized how much he'd been doing nothing but waiting for this moment, and here it was. There she was, and he knew. He knew. He moved slowly across the lawn, food and Kate forgotten. He managed to murmur his greetings to the one or two people he passed on his way, still keeping his pace. He had to reach her. He had to see her face, breathe her scent, know the sound of her voice. And then he was there, standing mere feet away. He was breathless, awed, somehow fulfilled merely to stand in her presence. She was speaking with another young lady, with enough animation to mark them as good friends. He stood there for a moment, just watching them, until they slowly turned and realized he was there. He smiled, softly, just a little bit. And he said, "How do you do?" Lucinda Abernathy better known to, well, everyone who knew her, as Lucy, stifled a groan as she turned to the gentleman who had crept up on her, presumably to make calf eyes at Hermione, as did, well, everyone who met Hermione. It was an occupational hazard of being friends with Hermione Watson. She collected broken hearts the way the old vicar down by the abbey collected butterflies. The only difference being, of course, that Hermione didn't jab her collection with nasty little pins. In all fairness, Hermione didn't wish to win the hearts of gentlemen, and she certainly never set out to break any of them. It just happened. Lucy was used to it by now. Hermione was Hermione, with pale blonde hair the colour of butter, a heart-shaped face, and huge wide-set eyes of the most startling shade of green. Lucy, on the other hand, was, well, she wasn't Hermione. That much was clear. She was simply herself, and most of the time that was enough. Lucy was, in almost every visible way, just a little bit less than Hermione. A little less blonde, a little less slender, a little less tall. Her eyes were a little less vivid in colour. Bluish-grey, actually. Quite attractive when compared with anyone other than Hermione, but that did her little good, as she never went anywhere without Hermione. She had come to this stunning conclusion one day, while not paying attention to her lessons on English composition and literature at Miss Moss's School for Exceptional Young Ladies, where she and Hermione had been students for 3 years. Lucy was a little bit less. Or perhaps, if one wanted to put a nicer sheen on it, she was simply not quite. She was, she supposed, reasonably attractive, in that healthy, traditional English rose sort of manner. But men were rarely, oh, very well, never, struck dumb in her presence. Hermione, however, well, it was a good thing she was such a nice person. She would have been impossible to be friends with otherwise. Well, that and the fact that she simply could not dance. Waltz, quadrille, minuet, it really didn't matter. If it involved music and movement, Hermione couldn't do it. And it was lovely. Lucy didn't think herself a particularly shallow person, and she would have insisted, had anyone asked, that she would freely throw herself in front of a carriage for her dearest friend. But there was a sort of satisfying fairness in the fact that the most beautiful girl in England had two left feet, at least one of them club, metaphorically speaking. And now here was another one. Man, of course, not foot. Handsome, too. Tall, although not overly so, with warm brown hair and a rather pleasing smile. And a twinkle in his eye as well, the colour of which she couldn't quite determine in the dim night air. Not to mention that she could actually see his eyes, as he wasn't looking at her. He was looking at Hermione, as men always did. Lucy smiled politely, even though she couldn't imagine that he'd notice, and waited for him to bow and introduce himself. And then he did the most astonishing thing. After disclosing his name, she should have known he was a Bridgerton from the looks of him, he leaned down and kissed her hand first. Lucy's breath caught. And then, of course, she realized what he was doing. Oh, he was good. He was really good. Nothing, nothing would endear a man to Hermione faster than a compliment to Lucy. Too bad for him that Hermione's heart was otherwise engaged. Oh, well, it would be amusing to watch it all play out, at least. "I'm Miss Hermione Watson," Hermione was saying, and Lucy realized that Mr. Bridgerton's tactics were doubly clever. By kissing Hermione's hand second, he could linger over it, and her, really, and then she would be the one required to make the introductions. Lucy was almost impressed. If nothing else, it marked him as slightly more intelligent than the average gentleman. "And this is my dearest friend," Hermione continued, "Lady Lucinda Abernathy." She said it the way she always said it, with love and devotion, and perhaps just the barest touch of desperation, as if to say, "For heaven's sake, spare Lucy a glance too." But of course they never did, except when they wanted advice concerning Hermione, her heart, and the winning thereof. When that happened, Lucy was always in high demand. Mr. Bridgerton. Mr. Gregory Bridgerton, Lucy mentally corrected, for there were, as far as she knew, three Mr. Bridgertons in total, not counting the Viscount, of course, turned and surprised her with a winning smile and warm eyes. "How do you do, Lady Lucinda?" he murmured. "Very well, thank you." And then she could have kicked herself, for she actually stammered before the V in Very, but for heaven's sake, they never looked at her after gazing upon Hermione. Never. Could he possibly be interested in her? No, impossible. They never were. And really, did it matter? Of course, it would be rather charming if a man fell madly and passionately in love with her for a change. Really, she wouldn't mind the attention. But the truth was, Lucy was practically engaged to Lord Hazelby, and had been for years and years, and years. So there was no use in having a besotted admirer of her own. It wasn't as if it could lead to anything useful. And that besides, it certainly wasn't Hermione's fault that she'd been born with the face of an angel. So Hermione was the siren, and Lucy was the trusty friend, and all was right with the world. Or if not right, then at least quite predictable. "May we count you among our hosts?" Lucy finally asked, since no one had said anything once they'd all finished with the requisite "pleased to meet yous." "I'm afraid not," Mr. Bridgerton replied. "Much as I would like to take credit for the festivities, I reside in London." "You are very fortunate to have Aubrey Hall in your family," Hermione said politely, "even if it is your brother's." And that was when Lucy knew. Mr. Bridgerton fancied Hermione. Forget that he'd kissed her hand first, or that he'd actually looked at her when she said something, which most men never bothered to do. One had only to see the way he regarded Hermione when she spoke, to know that he, too, had joined the throngs. His eyes had that slightly glazed look. His lips were parted, and there was an intensity there, as if he'd like to gather Hermione up and stride down the hill with her, crowds and propriety be damned. As opposed to the way he looked at her, which could be quite easily catalogued as polite disinterest. Or perhaps it was, "Why are you blocking my way, thus preventing me from sweeping Hermione up in my arms and striding down the hill with her, crowds and propriety be damned?" It wasn't disappointing, exactly. Just not undisappointing. There ought to be a word for that. Really, there ought. "Lucy? Lucy?" Lucy realized with a touch of embarrassment that she had not been paying attention to the conversation. Hermione was regarding her curiously, her head tilted in that manner of hers that men always seem to find so fetching. Lucy had tried it once. It made her dizzy. "Yes?" she murmured, since some sort of verbal expression seemed to be in order. "Mr. Bridgerton has asked me to dance," Hermione said, "but I have told him that I cannot." Hermione was forever feigning twisted ankles and head colds to keep herself off the dance floor, which was also all good and fine, except that she fobbed off all her admirers on Lucy, which was all good and fine at first, but it had got so common that Lucy suspected that the gentlemen now thought they were being shoved in her direction out of pity, which couldn't have been further from the truth. Lucy was, if she did say so herself, a rather fine dancer, and an excellent conversationalist as well. "It would be my pleasure to lead Lady Lucinda in a dance," Mr. Bridgerton said, because really, what else could he say? And so Lucy smiled, not entirely heartfelt, but a smile nonetheless, and allowed him to lead her to the patio. Chapter 2, in which our heroine displays a decided lack of respect for all things romantic. Gregory was nothing if not a gentleman, and he hid his disappointment well as he offered his arm to Lady Lucinda and escorted her to the makeshift dance floor. She was, he was sure, a perfectly charming and lovely young lady, but she wasn't Miss Hermione Watson, and he'd been waiting his entire life to meet Miss Hermione Watson. Still, this could be considered beneficial to his cause. Lady Lucinda was clearly Miss Watson's closest friend. Miss Watson had positively gushed about her during their brief conversation, during which time Lady Lucinda gazed off at something beyond his shoulder, apparently not listening to a word. And with four sisters, Gregory knew a thing or two about women, the most important of which was that it was always a good idea to befriend the friend, providing they really were friends, and not just being that odd thing women did when they pretended to be friends and were actually just waiting for the perfect moment to knife each other in the ribs. Mysterious creatures, women. If they could just learn to say what they meant, the world would be a far simpler place. But Miss Watson and Lady Lucinda gave every appearance of friendship and devotion, Lady Lucinda's wool-gathering aside. And if Gregory wished to learn more about Miss Watson, Lady Lucinda Abernathy was the obvious place to start. "Have you been a guest at Aubrey Hall very long?" Gregory asked politely, as they waited for the music to begin.
"Just since yesterday," she replied. "And you? We did not see you at any of the gatherings thus far."
"I only arrived this evening," he said. "After supper." He grimaced. Now that he was no longer gazing upon Miss Watson, he remembered that he was rather hungry.
"You must be famished," Lady Lucinda exclaimed. "Would you prefer to take a turn around the patio instead of dancing? I promise that we may stroll past the refreshment table."
Gregory could have hugged her. "You, Lady Lucinda, are a capital young lady." She smiled, but it was an odd sort of smile, and he couldn't quite tell what it meant. She'd liked his compliment, of that he was fairly certain, but there was something else there as well, something a little bit rueful, maybe something a little bit resigned.
"You must have a brother," he said.
"I do," she confirmed, smiling at his deduction. "He is 4 years my elder, and always hungry. I will be forever amazed we had any food in the larder when he was home from school."
Gregory fit her hand in the crook of his elbow, and together they moved to the perimeter of the patio.
"This way,"
Lady Lucinda said, giving his arm a little tug when he tried to steer them in a counterclockwise direction. "Unless you would prefer sweets." Gregory felt his face light up.
"Are those savouries?"
"Sandwiches. They're small, but they're quite delicious. Especially the egg."
He nodded somewhat absently. He'd caught sight of Miss Watson out of the corner of his eye, and it was a bit difficult to concentrate on anything else, especially as she'd been surrounded by men. Gregory was sure that they'd been just waiting for someone to remove Lady Lucinda from her side before moving in for the attack.
"Have you known Miss Watson very long?" he asked, trying not to be too obvious.
There was a very slight pause, and then she said,
"3 years. We are students together at Miss Moss's, or rather we were students together. We completed our studies earlier this year."
"May I assume you plan to make your debuts in London later this spring?"
"Yes,"
she replied, nodding towards a table laden with small snacks.
"We have spent the last few months preparing, as Hermione's mother likes to call it, attending house parties and small gatherings."
"Polishing yourselves?"
he asked with a smile. Her lips curved in answer.
"Exactly that. I should make an excellent candlestick by now."
He found himself amused.
"A mere candlestick, Lady Lucinda. Pray do not understate your value. At the very least, you are one of those extravagant silver urns everyone seems to need in their sitting rooms lately."
"I am an urn, then," she said, almost appearing to consider the idea.
"What would that make Hermione, I wonder?" "A jewel, a diamond set in gold, a diamond set in gold surrounded by—"
He forcibly halted the direction of his thoughts. He could perform his most poetic gymnastics later, when he wasn't expected to keep up one end of a conversation. A conversation with a different young lady.
"I'm sure I do not know," he said lightly, offering her a plate. "I've only barely made Miss Watson's acquaintance, after all."
She said nothing, but her eyebrows rose ever so slightly. And that, of course, was when Gregory realized he was glancing over her shoulder to get a better look at Miss Watson. Lady Lucinda let out a small sigh.
"You should probably know that she is in love with someone else."
Gregory dragged his gaze back to the woman he was meant to be paying attention to.
"I beg your pardon?"
She shrugged delicately as she placed a few small sandwiches on her plate.
"Hermione, she's in love with someone else. I thought you would like to know."
Gregory gaped at her,
and then, against every last drop of his good judgment, looked back at Miss Watson. It was the most obvious, pathetic gesture, but he couldn't help himself. He just... dear God, he just wanted to look at her, and look at her and never stop. If this wasn't love, he could not imagine what was.
Ham?
What?
Ham.
Lady Lucinda was holding out a little strip of sandwich with a pair of serving tongs. Her face was annoyingly serene.
Would you care for one? She asked.
He grunted and held out his plate. And then, because he couldn't leave the matter as it was, he said stiffly, I'm sure it is none of my business.
About the sandwich?
About Miss Watson, he ground out. Even though, of course, he meant no such thing. As far as he was concerned, Hermione Watson was very much his business, or at least she would be, very soon. It was somewhat disconcerting that she had apparently not been hit by the same thunderbolt that had struck him. It had never occurred to him that when he did fall in love, his intended might not feel the same, and with equal immediacy, too. But at least this explanation, her thinking she was in love with someone else, assuaged his pride. It was much more palatable to think her infatuated with someone else than completely indifferent to him. All that was left to do was to make her realize that whoever the other man was, he was not the one for her. Gregory was not so filled with conceit that he thought he could win any woman upon whom he set his sights, but he certainly had never had difficulties with the fairer sex, and given the nature of his reaction to Miss Watson, it was simply inconceivable that his feelings would go unrequited for very long. He might have to work to win her heart and hand, but that would simply make victory all the sweeter. Or so he told himself. Truth was, a mutual thunderbolt would have been far less trouble.
"Don't feel badly," Lady Lucinda said, craning her neck slightly as she surveyed the sandwiches, looking presumably for something more exotic than British pig.
"I don't," he bit off, then waited for her to actually return her attention to him. When she didn't, he said again, "I don't." She turned, gazed at him frankly, and blinked.
"Well, that's refreshing, I must say. Most men are crushed."
He scowled. "What do you mean, most men are crushed?"
"Exactly what I said," she replied, giving him an impatient glance.
"Or if they're not crushed, they become rather unaccountably angry." She let out a ladylike snort. "As if any of it can be considered her fault."
"Fault?"
Gregory echoed, because in truth he was having a devil of a time following her. "You are not the first gentleman to imagine himself in love with Hermione," she said, her expression quite jaded. "It happens all the time."
"I don't imagine myself in love."
He cut himself off, hoping she didn't notice the stress on the word imagine. Good God, what was happening to him? He used to have a sense of humour, even about himself. Well, especially about himself.
"You don't?"
She sounded pleasantly surprised.
"Well, that's refreshing."
"Why," he asked with narrowed eyes, "is that refreshing?" She returned with,
"Why are you asking so many questions?"
"Well, I'm not," he protested, even though he was. She sighed, then utterly surprised him by saying,
"I'm sorry."
"I beg your pardon?" She glanced at the egg salad sandwich on her plate, then back up at him, the order of which he did not find complimentary. He usually rated above egg salad.
"I thought you would wish to speak of Hermione," she said. "I apologize if I was mistaken."
Which put Gregory in a fine quandary. He could admit that he'd fallen headlong in love with Miss Watson, which was rather embarrassing even to a hopeless romantic such as himself, or he could deny it all, which he clearly wouldn't believe. Or he could compromise, and admit to a mild infatuation, which he might normally regard as the best solution, except that it could only be insulting to Lady Lucinda. He'd met the two girls at the same time, after all, and he wasn't headlong in love with her. But then, as if she could read his thoughts, which frankly scared him, she waved a hand and said,
"Pray do not worry yourself over my feelings. I'm quite used to this. As I said, it happens all the time.
Open heart, insert blunt dagger, twist.
Not to mention," she continued blithely, "that I'm practically engaged myself."
And then she took a bite of the egg salad.
Gregory found himself wondering what sort of man had found himself attached to this odd creature. He didn't pity the fellow exactly, just wondered. And then Lady Lucinda let out a little, "Oh!" His eyes followed hers to the spot where Miss Watson had once stood. "I wonder where she went," Lady Lucinda said. Gregory immediately turned toward the door, hoping to catch one last glimpse of her before she disappeared. But she was already gone. It was damn frustrating, that. What was the point of a mad, bad, immediate attraction if one couldn't do anything about it? And forget all about it being one-sided. Good Lord. He wasn't sure what one called sighing through gritted teeth, but that's exactly what he did. "Ah, Lady Lucinda, there you are." Gregory looked up to see his sister-in-law approaching, and remembered that he'd forgotten all about her. Kate wouldn't take offence. She was a phenomenally good sport. But still, Gregory did usually try to have better manners with women to whom he was not blood-related. Lady Lucinda gave a pretty little curtsy. "Lady Bridgerton?" Kate smiled warmly in return. "Miss Watson has asked me to inform you that she was not feeling well and has retired for the evening."
"She has? Did she say—"
"Oh, never mind." Lady Lucinda gave a little wave with her hand, the sort meant to convey nonchalance. But Gregory saw the barest hint of frustration pinching at the corners of her mouth. "A head cold, I believe," Kate added. Lady Lucinda gave a brief nod. "Yes," she said, looking a bit less sympathetic than Gregory would have imagined, given the circumstances. "It would be." "And you," Kate continued, turning to Gregory, "have not even seen fit to greet me. How are you?" He took her hands, kissed them as one in apology. "Tardy." "That I knew." Her face assumed an expression that was not irritated, just a little bit exasperated. "How are you otherwise?" "Otherwise lovely," he grinned. "As always." "As always," she repeated, giving him a look that was a clear promise of future interrogation. "Lady Lucinda," Kate continued, her tone considerably less dry, "I trust you have made the acquaintance of my husband's brother, Mr. Gregory Bridgerton."
"Indeed,"
Lady Lucinda replied. "We have been admiring the food. The sandwiches are delicious." "Thank you," Kate said, then added, "And has Gregory promised you a dance? I cannot promise music of a professional quality, but we managed to round together a string quartet amongst our guests."
"He did,"
Lady Lucinda replied, "but I released him from his obligation so that he might assuage his hunger." "You must have brothers," Kate said with a smile. Lady Lucinda looked at Gregory with a slightly startled expression before replying, "Just one." He turned to Kate. "I made the same observation earlier," he explained. Kate let out a short laugh. "Great minds, to be sure." She turned to the younger woman and said, "It is well worth understanding the behavior of men, Lady Lucinda. One should never underestimate the power of food." Lady Lucinda regarded her with wide eyes.
"For the benefit of a pleasing mood?"
"Well, that," Kate said almost offhandedly. "But one really shouldn't discount its uses for the purpose of winning an argument, or simply getting what you want." "She's barely out of the schoolroom, Kate," Greg chided. Kate ignored him and instead smiled widely at Lady Lucinda. "One is never too young to acquire important skills." Lady Lucinda looked at Gregory, then at Kate, and then her eyes began to sparkle with humour. "I understand why so many look up to you, Lady Bridgerton." Kate laughed. "You are too kind, Lady Lucinda."
"Oh, please, Kate," Gregory cut in.
He turned to Lady Lucinda and added, "She will stand here all night if you keep offering compliments."
"Pay him no attention," Kate said with a grin.
"He is young and foolish and knows not of what he speaks." Gregory was about to make another comment. He couldn't very well allow Kate to get away with that. But then Lady Lucinda cut in.
"I would happily sing your praises for the rest of the evening, Lady Bridgerton, but I believe it is time for me to retire. I should like to check on Hermione. She has been under the weather all day, and I wish to assure myself that she is well."
"Of course," Kate replied. "Please do give her my regards, and be certain to ring if you need anything.
Our housekeeper fancies herself something of a herbalist, and she's always mixing potions. Some of them even work.
She grinned, and the expression was so friendly that Gregory instantly realized that she approved of Lady Lucinda, which meant something. Kate had never suffered fools, gladly or otherwise.
"I shall walk you to the door," he said quickly. It was the least he could do to offer her this courtesy, and besides, it would not do to insult Miss Watson's closest friend. They said their farewells, and Gregory fit her arm into the crook of his elbow. They walked in silence to the door, to the drawing-room, and Gregory said, "I trust you can make your own way from here."
"Of course," she replied, and then she looked up. Her eyes were bluish, he noticed almost absently, and asked, "Would you like me to convey a message to Hermione?"
His lips parted with surprise.
"Why would you do that?"
he asked, before he could think to temper his response.
She just shrugged and said, "You are the lesser of two evils, Mr. Bridgerton."
He wanted desperately to ask her to clarify that comment, but he could not ask, not on such a flimsy acquaintance. So instead, worked to maintain an even mien as he said,
"Give her my regards. That is all."
"Really?"
Damn, but that look in her eye was annoying.
"Really?"
She bobbed the tiniest of curtsies and was off. Gregory stared at the doorway through which she had disappeared for a moment, and then turned back to the party. The guests had begun dancing in greater numbers, and laughter was most certainly filling the air, but somehow the night felt dull and lifeless. Food, he decided. He'd eat 20 more of those tiny little sandwiches, and then he'd retire for the night as well. All would come clear in the morning. Lucy knew that Hermione didn't have a headache, or any sort of ache for that matter, and she was not at all surprised to find her sitting on her bed, poring over what appeared to be a 4-page letter, written in an extremely compact hand.
"A footman brought it to me," Hermione said, not even looking up. "He said it arrived in today's post, but they forgot to bring it earlier."
Lucy sighed.
"From Mr. Edmonds, I presume?"
Hermione nodded. Lucy crossed the room she and Hermione were currently sharing and sat down in the chair at the vanity table. This wasn't the first piece of correspondence Hermione had received from Mr. Edmonds, and Lucy knew from experience that Hermione would need to read it twice, then once again for deeper analysis, and then finally one last time, if only to pick apart any hidden meanings in the salutation and closing, which meant that Lucy would have nothing to do but examine her fingernails for at least 5 minutes. Which she did, not because she was terribly interested in her fingernails, nor because she was a particularly patient person, but rather because she knew a useless situation when she saw one, and she saw a little reason in expending the energy to engage Hermione in conversation, when Hermione was so patently uninterested in anything she had to say. Fingernails could only occupy a girl for so long, however, especially when they were already meticulously neat and groomed. So Lucy stood and walked to the wardrobe, peering absently at her belongings.
"Oh, dash," she muttered. "I hate when she does that."
Her maid had left a pair of shoes the wrong way, with the left on the right and the right on the left, and while Lucy knew there was nothing earth-shatteringly wrong with that, it did offend some strange and extremely tidy little corner of her sensibilities. So she righted the slippers, then stood back to inspect her handiwork, then planted her hands on her hips and turned around.
"Are you finished yet?" she demanded. "Almost,"
Hermione said, and it sounded as if the word had been resting on the edge of her lips the whole time, as if she had it ready so that she could fob off Lucy when she asked. Lucy sat back down with a huff. It was a scene they had played out countless times before, or at least four. Yes, Lucy knew exactly how many letters Hermione had received from the romantic Mr. Edmonds. She would have liked not to have known. In fact, she was more than a little irritated that the item was taking up valuable space in her brain that might have been devoted to something useful, like botany or music. Or, good heavens, even another page into Brett's. But the unfortunate fact was, Mr. Edmonds' letters were nothing if not an event. And when Hermione had an event, well, Lucy was forced to have it too. They had shared a room for 3 years at Miss Moss's,
and since Lucy had no close female relative who might help her make her bow into society, Hermione's mother had agreed to sponsor her, and so here they were, still together. Which was lovely, really, except for the always present, in spirit at least, Mr. Edmonds. Lucy had made his acquaintance only once, but it certainly felt as if he were always there, hovering over them, causing Hermione to sigh at strange moments and gaze wistfully off into the distance, as if she were committing a love sonnet to memory so that she might include it in her next reply. "You are aware," Lucy said, even though Hermione had not indicated that she was finished reading her missive, "that your parents will never permit you to marry him." That was enough to get Hermione to set the letter down, albeit briefly. "Yes," she said with an irritated expression. "You've said as much." "He is a secretary," Lucy said.
"I realize that."
"A secretary," Lucy repeated, even though they'd had this conversation countless times before. "Your father's secretary." Hermione had picked the letter back up in an attempt to ignore Lucy, but finally she gave up and set it back down again, confirming Lucy's suspicions that she had long since finished it and was now in the first or possibly even second rereading. "Mr. Edmonds is a good and honourable man," Hermione said, lips pinched.
"I'm sure he is," Lucy said, "but you can't marry him. Your father is a Viscount. Do you really think he will allow his only daughter to marry a penniless secretary?"
"My father loves me," Hermione muttered, but her voice wasn't exactly replete with conviction.
"I'm not trying to dissuade you from making a love match," Lucy began, "but that is exactly what you're trying to do," Hermione cut in.
"Not at all. I just don't see why you can't try to fall in love with someone of whom your parents might actually approve." Hermione's lovely mouth twisted into a frustrated line.
"You don't understand."
"What is there to understand? Don't you think your life might be just a touch easier if you fell in love with someone suitable?"
"Lucy, we don't get to choose whom we fall in love with."
Lucy crossed her arms.
"I don't see why not."
Hermione's mouth actually fell open.
"Lucy Abernathy," she said, "you understand nothing."
"Yes," Lucy said dryly. "You've mentioned."
"How can you possibly think a person can choose who she falls in love with?"
Hermione said passionately, although not so passionately that she was forced to rouse herself from her semi-reclined position on the bed.
"One doesn't choose. It just happens. In an instant."
"Now that I don't believe," Lucy replied, and then added because she could not resist. "Not for an instant."
"Well, it does," Hermione insisted. "I know, because it happened to me. I wasn't looking to fall in love."
"Weren't you?"
"No."
Hermione glared at her.
"I wasn't. I fully intended to find a husband in London. Really, who would have expected to meet anyone in Finchley?"
Said with the sort of disdain found only in a native Finchleyan. Lucy rolled her eyes and tilted her head to one side, waiting for Hermione to get on with it, which Hermione did not appreciate.
"Don't look at me like that," she snipped.
"Like what?"
"Like that. I repeat, like what?"
Hermione's entire face pinched.
"You know exactly what I'm talking about."
Lucy clapped a hand to her face.
"Oh, my," she gasped. "You looked exactly like your mother just then."
Hermione drew back with a front.
"That was unkind."
"Your mother is lovely.
Not when her face is all pinchy."
"Your mother is lovely even with a pinchy face," Lucy said, trying to put an end to the subject.
"Now, do you intend to tell me about Mr. Edmonds or not?" "Do you plan to mock me?"
"Of course not." Hermione lifted her brows.
"Hermione, I promise I will not mock you."
Hermione still looked dubious, but she said,
"Very well. But if you do, Hermione..." "As I told you," she said, giving Lucy a warning glance, "I wasn't expecting to find love. I didn't even know my father had hired a new secretary. I was just walking in the garden, deciding which of the roses I wished to have cut for the table. And then I saw him,"
said with enough drama to warrant a role on the stage.
"Oh, Hermione," Lucy sighed. "You said you wouldn't mock me," Hermione said, and she actually jabbed a finger in Lucy's direction, which struck Lucy as sufficiently out of character that she quieted down.
"I didn't even see his face at first," Hermione continued. "Just the back of his head. The way his hair curled against the collar of his coat."
She sighed then. She actually sighed as she turned to Lucy with the most pathetic expression.
"And the colour. Truly, Lucy, have you ever seen hair such a spectacular shade of blonde?"
Considering the number of times Lucy had been forced to listen to gentlemen make the same statement about Hermione's hair, she thought it spoke rather well of her that she refrained from comment. But Hermione was not done. Not nearly.
"Then he turned," she said, "and I saw his profile, and I swear to you, I heard music."
Lucy would have liked to point out that the Watsons' conservatory was located right next to the Rose Garden, but she held her tongue.
"And then he turned," Hermione said,
her voice growing soft and her eyes taking on that "I'm memorizing a love sonnet" expression.
"And all I could think of was, I am ruined."
Lucy gasped.
"Don't say that. Don't even hint at it."
Ruin was not the sort of thing any young lady mentioned lightly.
"Well, not ruined, ruined," Hermione said impatiently. "Good heavens, Lucy, I was in the Rose Garden. Or haven't you been listening? But I knew. I knew that I was ruined for all other men. There could never be another to compare."
"And you knew all this from the back of his neck?" Lucy asked. Hermione shot her an exceedingly irritated expression.
"And his profile. But that's not the point."
Lucy waited patiently for the point, even though she was quite certain it wouldn't be one with which she would agree, or probably even understand.
"The point is," Hermione said,
her voice growing so soft that Lucy had to lean forward to hear her,
"that I cannot possibly be happy without him. Not possibly."
"Well," Lucy said slowly, because she wasn't precisely certain how she was meant to add to that,
"you seem happy now." "That is only because I know he's waiting for me. And,"
Hermione held up the letter,
"he writes that he loves me."
"Oh, dear," Lucy said to herself. Hermione must have heard her because her mouth tightened, but she didn't say anything. The two of them just sat there in their respective places for a full minute. And then Lucy cleared her throat and said, "That nice Mr. Bridgerton seemed taken with you." Hermione shrugged. "He's a younger son, but I believe he has a nice portion, and he is certainly from a good family."
"Lucy, I told you, I'm not interested."
"Well, he is very handsome," Lucy said, perhaps a bit more emphatically than she'd meant to.
"You pursue him, then," Hermione retorted.
Lucy stared at her in shock.
"You know I cannot. I'm practically engaged to Lord Hazelby."
"Practically," Hermione reminded her.
"Well, it might as well be official," Lucy said.
And it was true. Her uncle had discussed the matter with the Earl of Davenport, Viscount Hazelby's father, years ago. Hazelby was about 10 years older than Lucy, and they were all simply waiting for her to grow up, which she supposed she'd done. Surely the wedding wouldn't be too far off now. And it was a good match. Hazelby was a perfectly pleasant fellow. He didn't speak to her as if she were an idiot. He seemed to be kind to animals, and his looks were pleasing enough, even if his hair was beginning to thin. Of course, Lucy had only actually met her intended husband 3 times, but everyone knew that first impressions were extremely important and usually spot-on accurate. Besides, her uncle had been her guardian since her father had died 10 years earlier, and if he hadn't exactly showered her and her brother Richard with love and affection, he had done his duty by them and raised them well. And Lucy knew that it was her duty to obey his wishes and honour the betrothal he had arranged, or practically arranged. Really, it didn't make much difference. She was going to marry Hazelby. Everyone knew it.
"I think you use him as an excuse," Hermione said.
Lucy's spine stiffened.
"I beg your pardon?" "You use Hazelby as an excuse," Hermione repeated, and her face took on a lofty expression Lucy did not enjoy one bit. "So that you do not allow your heart to become engaged elsewhere."
"And just where else, precisely, might I have engaged my heart?" Lucy demanded. "The season has not even begun." Perhaps, Hermione said, but we've been out and about getting polished, as you and my mother like to put it. You have not been living under a rock, Lucy. You have met any number of men. There was really no way to point out that none of those men had even saw her when Hermione was near. Hermione would try to deny it, but they would both know that she was lying in an attempt to spare Lucy's feelings. So Lucy instead grumbled something under her breath that was meant to be a reply without actually being a reply. And then Hermione did not say anything. She just looked at her in that arch manner that she never used with anyone else. And finally, Lucy had to defend herself. "It's not an excuse," she said, crossing her arms, then planting her hands on her hips when that didn't feel right. "Truly, what would be the point of it? You know that I'm to marry Hazelby. It's been planned for ages." She crossed her arms again, then dropped them, then finally sat down. "It's not a bad match," Lucy said. "Truthfully, after what happened to Georgiana Whitten, I should be getting down on my hands and knees and kissing my uncle's feet for making such an acceptable alliance." There was a moment of horrified, almost reverent silence. If they had been Catholic, they would have surely crossed themselves. "There, but for the grace of God," Hermione finally said. Lucy nodded slowly. Georgiana had been married off to a wheezy 70-year-old with gout, and not even a titled 70-year-old with gout. Good heavens, she ought to have at least earned a lady before her name for her sacrifice. "So you see," Lucy finished, "Hazelby really isn't such a bad sort. Better than most, actually." Hermione looked at her closely. "Well, if it is what you wish, Lucy, you know that I shall support you unreservedly. But as for me..." She sighed, and her green eyes took on that faraway look that made grown men swoon. "I want something else." "I know you do," Lucy said, trying to smile. But she couldn't even begin to imagine how Hermione would achieve her dreams. In the world they lived in, Viscounts' daughters did not marry Viscounts' secretaries. And it seemed to Lucy that it would make far more sense to adjust Hermione's dreams than to reshape the social order. Easier, too. But right now, she was tired, and she wanted to go to bed. She would work on Hermione in the morning, starting with that handsome Mr. Bridgerton. He would be perfect for her friend, and heaven knew he was interested. Hermione would come around. Lucy would make sure of it.
Chapter 3, in which our hero tries very, very hard. The following morning was bright and clear, and as Gregory helped himself to breakfast, his sister-in-law appeared at his side, smiling faintly, clearly up to something. "Good morning," she said, far too breezy and cheerful. Gregory nodded his greeting as he heaped eggs on his plate. "Kate, I thought with the weather so fine that we might organize an excursion to the village." "To buy ribbons and bows?" "Exactly," she replied. "I do think it's important to support the local shopkeepers, don't you?"
"Of course," he murmured, "although I've not recently found myself in great need of ribbons and bows."
Kate appeared not to notice his sarcasm.
"All of the young ladies have a bit of pin money, and nowhere to spend it. If I do not send them to town, they are liable to start a gaming establishment in the Rose Salon."
Now that was something he'd like to see. "And," Kate continued quite determinedly, "if I send them to town, I will need to send them with escorts." When Gregory did not respond quickly enough, she repeated, "With escorts." Gregory cleared his throat.
Might I assume you are asking me to walk to the village this afternoon?"
"This morning," she clarified. "And since I thought to match everyone up, and since you are a Bridgerton and thus my favourite gentleman of the bunch, I thought I might inquire if there happened to be anyone with whom you might prefer to be paired." Kate was nothing if not a matchmaker. But in this case, Gregory decided he ought to be grateful for her meddling tendencies. "As a matter of fact," he began.
"There is excellent," Kate interrupted, clapping her hands together. "Lucy Abernathy it is."
Lucy Abernathy, he repeated, dumbfounded. "The Lady Lucinda?"
"Yes. Well, the two of you seemed so well matched last evening, and I must say, Gregory, I like her tremendously. She says she's practically engaged, but in my opinion that I'm not interested in Lady Lucinda. He cut in, deciding it would be too dangerous to wait for Kate to draw breath. You're not?
No, I'm not.
He leaned in, even though they were the only two people in the breakfast room. Somehow it seemed odd and, yes, a little bit embarrassing to shout it out.
Hermione Watson, he said quietly. I would like to be paired with Miss Watson.
Really?
Kate didn't look disappointed exactly, but she did look slightly resigned, as if she'd heard this before, repeatedly.
Damn.
Yes, Gregory responded, and he felt a rather sizable surge of irritation washing over him. First at Kate, because, well, she was right there, and he'd fallen desperately in love, and all she could say was, really. But then he realized he'd been rather irked all morning. He hadn't slept well the night before. He hadn't been able to stop thinking about Hermione and the slope of her neck, the green of her eyes, the soft lilt of her voice. He had never, never reacted to a woman like this. And while he was in some way relieved to have finally found the woman he planned to make his wife, it was a bit disconcerting that she had not had the same reaction to him. Heaven knew he'd dreamed of this moment before. Whenever he thought about finding his true love, she had always been fuzzy in his thoughts, nameless, faceless. But she had always felt the same grand passion. She hadn't sent him off dancing with her best friend, for God's sake.
Hermione Watson it is, then,
Kate said, exhaling in that way females did when they meant to tell you something you couldn't possibly begin to understand, even if they had chosen to convey it in English, which, of course, they did not. Hermione Watson it was, Hermione Watson it would be. Soon. Maybe even that morning.
"Do you suppose there's anything to purchase in the village aside from bows and ribbons?"
Hermione asked Lucy as they pulled on their gloves.
"Well, I certainly hope so," Lucy responded. "They do this at every house party, don't they? Send us off with our pin money to purchase ribbons and bows. I could decorate an entire house by now, or at the very least a small thatched cottage."
Hermione smiled gamely.
"I shall donate mine to the cause, and together we shall remake a..."
She paused, thinking, then smiled.
"A large thatched cottage."
Lucy grinned. There was something so loyal about Hermione. Nobody ever saw it, of course. No one ever bothered to look past her face. Although, to be fair, Hermione rarely shared enough of herself with any of her admirers for them to realize what lay behind her pretty exterior. It wasn't that she was shy, precisely, although she certainly wasn't as outgoing as Lucy. Rather, Hermione was private. She simply did not care to share her thoughts and opinions with people she did not know. And it drove the gentleman mad. Lucy peered out the window as they entered one of Aubrey Hall's many drawing rooms. Lady Bridgerton had instructed them to arrive promptly at 11.
"At least it doesn't look as if it might rain," she said.
The last time they'd been sent out for fripperies, it had drizzled the entire way home. The tree canopy had kept them moderately dry, but their boots had been nearly ruined. And Lucy had been sneezing for a week.
"Good morning, Lady Lucinda. Miss Watson?"
It was Lady Bridgerton, their hostess, striding into the room in that confident way of hers. Her dark hair was neatly pulled back, and her eyes gleamed with brisk intelligence.
"How lovely to see you both," she said. "You are the last of the ladies to arrive."
"We are?" Lucy asked, horrified. She hated being late.
"I'm so terribly sorry. Didn't you say 11 o'clock?
"Oh, dear, I did not mean to upset you," Lady Bridgerton said. "I did indeed say 11 o'clock, but that is because I thought to send everyone out in shifts."
"In shifts?" Hermione echoed.
"Yes. It's far more entertaining that way, wouldn't you agree? I have 8 ladies and 8 gentlemen. If I sent the lot of you out at once, it would be impossible to have a proper conversation, not to mention the width of the road. I would hate for you to be tripping over one another."
There was also something to be said for safety in numbers, but Lucy kept her thoughts to herself. Lady Bridgerton clearly had some sort of agenda, and as Lucy had already decided that she greatly admired the Viscountess, she was rather curious as to the outcome.
"Miss Watson, you'll be paired with my husband's brother.
I believe you made his acquaintance last night.
Hermione nodded politely. Lucy smiled to herself. Mr. Bridgerton had been a busy man that morning. Well done.
And you, Lady Lucinda, Lady Bridgerton continued, will be escorted by Mr. Burbrook.
She smiled weakly, almost in apology.
He is a relation of sorts, she added, and truly a good-natured fellow.
A relation? Lucy echoed, since she wasn't exactly certain how she was meant to respond to Lady Bridgerton's uncharacteristically hesitant tone.
Of sorts? Yes. My husband's brother's wife's sister is married to his brother.
Oh. Lucy kept her expression bland.
Then you are close.
Lady Bridgerton laughed.
I like you, Lady Lucinda. And as for Neville, well, I'm certain you'll find him entertaining. Ah, here he is now. Neville? Neville?
Lucy watched as Lady Bridgerton moved to greet Mr. Neville Burbrook at the door. They had already been introduced, of course. Introductions had been made for everyone at the house party. But Lucy had not yet conversed with Mr. Burbrook, nor truly ever seen him except from afar. He seemed an affable enough fellow, rather jolly-looking with a ruddy complexion and a shock of blonde hair.
"Hello, Lady Bridgerton,"
he said, somehow crashing into a table leg as he entered the room.
"Excellent breakfast this morning, especially at Kipper's."
"Thank you," Lady Bridgerton replied, glancing nervously at the Chinese vase now teetering on the tabletop.
"I'm sure you remember Lady Lucinda."
The pair murmured their greetings. Then Mr. Burbrook said,
"Do you like Kippers?"
Lucy looked first to Hermione, then to Lady Bridgerton for guidance, but neither seemed any less baffled than she, so she just said,
Yes. "Oh, excellent," he said. "I say, is that a tufted tern out the window?"
Lucy blinked. She looked to Lady Bridgerton, only to discover that the Viscountess would not make eye contact.
"A tufted tern, you say?"
Lucy finally murmured, since she could not think of any other suitable reply. Mr. Burbrook had ambled over to the window, so she went to join him. She peered out. She could see no birds. Meanwhile, out of the corner of her eye, she could see that Mr. Bridgerton had entered the room and was doing his best to charm Hermione. Good heavens, the man had a nice smile, even white teeth, and the expression extended to his eyes, unlike most of the bored young aristocrats Lucy had met. Mr. Bridgerton smiled, as if he meant it. Which made sense, of course, as he was smiling at Hermione, with whom he was quite obviously infatuated. Lucy could not hear what they were saying, but she easily recognized the expression on Hermione's face. Polite, of course, since Hermione would never be impolite. And maybe no one could see it but Lucy, who knew her friend so well, but Hermione was doing no more than tolerating Mr. Bridgerton's attentions, accepting his flattery with a nod and a pretty smile, while her mind was far, far elsewhere. With that cursed Mr. Edmonds. Lucy clenched her jaw as she pretended to look for terns, tufted or otherwise, with Mr. Burbrook. She had no reason to think Mr. Edmonds anything but a nice young man, but the simple truth was, Hermione's parents would never countenance the match, and while Hermione might think she would be able to live happily on a secretary's salary, Lucy was quite certain that once the first bloom of marriage faded, Hermione would be miserable. And she could do so much better. It was obvious that Hermione could marry anyone. Anyone. She wouldn't need to settle. She could be a queen of the ton if she so desired. Lucy eyed Mr. Bridgerton, nodding, and keeping one ear on Mr. Burbrook, who was back on the subject of kippers. Mr. Bridgerton was perfect. He didn't possess a title, but Lucy was not so ruthless that she felt Hermione had to marry into the highest available rank. She just could not align herself with the secretary, for heaven's sake. Plus, Mr. Bridgerton was extremely handsome, with dark chestnut hair and lovely hazel eyes, and his family seemed perfectly nice and reasonable, which Lucy had to think was a point in his favour. When you married a man, you married his family, really. Lucy couldn't imagine a better husband for Hermione. Well, she supposed she would not complain if Mr. Bridgerton were next in line for a marquisette, but really, one could not have everything. And most importantly, she was quite certain that he would make Hermione happy, even if Hermione did not yet realize this. "I will make this happen," she said to herself.
Eh?
From Mr. Burbrook. Did you find the bird?
Over there,
Lucy said, pointing toward a tree. He leaned forward.
Really?
Oh, Lucy, came Hermione's voice. Lucy turned around.
Shall we be off? Mr. Bridgerton is eager to be on his way.
I am at your service, Miss Watson, the man in question said. We depart at your discretion. Hermione gave Lucy a look that clearly said that she was eager to be on her way. So Lucy said,
Let us depart, then.
And she took Mr. Burbrook's proffered arm and allowed him to lead her to the front drive, managing to yelp only once, even though she thrice stubbed her toe on heaven knew what. But somehow, even with a nice, lovely expanse of grass, Mr. Burbrook managed to find every tree root, rock, and bump, and lead her directly to them.
Gad!
Lucy mentally prepared herself for further injury. It was going to be a painful outing.
But a productive one.
By the time they returned home, Hermione would be at least a little intrigued by Mr. Bridgerton. Lucy would make sure of it. If Gregory had had any doubts about Miss Hermione Watson, they were banished the moment he placed her hand in the crook of his elbow. There was a rightness to it, a strange mystical sense of two halves coming together. She fit perfectly next to him. They fit. And he wanted her. It wasn't even desire. It was strange, actually. He wasn't feeling anything so plebeian as bodily desire. It was something else, something within. He simply wanted her to be his. He wanted to look at her and to know. To know that she would carry his name and bear his children and gaze lovingly at him every morning over a cup of chocolate. He wanted to tell her all of this, to share his dreams, to paint a picture of their life together. But he was no fool, and so he simply said as he guided her down the front path, "You look exceptionally lovely this morning, Miss Watson."
"Thank you,"
she said. And then said nothing else. He cleared his throat.
Did you sleep well?
Yes, thank you, she said.
Are you enjoying your stay?
Yes, thank you, she said. Funny, but he'd always thought conversation with the woman he'd marry would come just a little bit easier. He reminded himself that she still fancied herself in love with another man, someone unsuitable, if Lady Lucinda's comment of the night before was any indication. What had she called him? The lesser of two evils? He glanced forward. A Lady Lucinda was stumbling along ahead of him on the arm of Neville Bearbrook, who had never learned to adjust his gait for a lady. She seemed to be managing well enough, although he did think he might have heard a small cry of pain at one point. He gave his head a mental shake. It was probably just a bird. Hadn't Neville said he'd seen a flock of them through the window? Have you been friends with Lady Lucinda for very long? He asked Miss Watson. He knew the answer, of course. Lady Lucinda had told him the night before, but he couldn't think of anything else to ask, and he needed a question that could not be answered with yes, thank you, or no, thank you.
3 years, Miss Watson replied. She is my dearest friend.
And then her face finally took on a bit of animation as she said,
We ought to catch up.
To Mr. Burbrook and Lady Lucinda.
Yes,
she said with a firm nod.
Yes, we ought.
The last thing Gregory wanted to do was squander his precious time alone with Miss Watson, but he dutifully called out to Burbrook to hold on. He did, stopping so suddenly that Lady Lucinda quite literally crashed into him. She let out a startled cry, but other than that, was clearly unhurt. Miss Watson took advantage of the moment, however, by disengaging her hand from his elbow and rushing forward.
Lucy! She cried out. "Oh, my dearest Lucy, are you injured?"
"Not at all," Lady Lucinda replied, looking slightly confused by the extreme level of her friend's concern.
"I must take your arm," Miss Watson declared, hooking her elbow through Lady Lucinda's.
"You must?" Lady Lucinda echoed, twisting away, or rather, attempting to.
"No, truly, that is not necessary." "I insist." "It's not necessary," Lady Lucinda repeated.
And Gregory wished he could see her face, because it sounded as if she were gritting her teeth.
"Hey!" came Burbrook's voice. "Perhaps I'll take your arm, Bridgerton."
Gregory gave him a level look. "No." Burbrook blinked.
"It was a joke, you know."
Gregory fought the urge to sigh, and somehow managed to say,
I was aware. He'd known Neville Burbrook since they'd both been in leading strings, and he usually had more patience with him. But right now, he wanted nothing so much as to fit him with a muzzle. Meanwhile, the two girls were bickering about something, in tones hushed enough that Gregory couldn't hope to make out what they were saying. And not that he'd likely have understood their language, even if they'd been shouting it. It was clearly something bafflingly female. Lady Lucinda was still tugging her arm, and Miss Watson quite simply refused to let go.
"She's injured," Hermione said, turning and batting her eyelashes.
Batting her eyelashes? She chose this moment to flirt?
"I am not," Lucy returned.
She turned to the two gentlemen.
"I am not," she repeated, "not in the slightest. We should continue."
Gregory couldn't quite decide if he was amused or insulted by the entire spectacle. Miss Watson quite clearly did not wish for his escort, and while some men loved to pine for the unattainable, he'd always preferred his women smiling, friendly, and willing. Miss Watson turned then, however, and he caught sight of the back of her neck. What was it about the back of her neck? He felt himself sinking again, that madly in love feeling that had captured him the night before, and he told himself not to lose heart. He hadn't even known her a full day. She merely needed time to get to know him. Love did not strike everyone with the same speed. His brother Colin, for example, had known his wife for years and years before he realized they were meant to be together. And not that Gregory planned to wait years and years. But still, it did put the current situation in a better perspective. After a few moments, it became apparent that Miss Watson would not acquiesce, and the two women would be walking arm in arm. Gregory fell in step beside Miss Watson, while Burbrook ambled on somewhere in the vicinity of Lady Lucinda.
"You must tell us what it is like to be from such a large family," Lady Lucinda said to him, leaning forward and speaking past Miss Watson. "Hermione and I each have but one sibling."
"Have three myself," said Burbrook. "All boys, all of us. Except for my sister, of course."
"It is..." Gregory was about to give his usual answer about it being mad and crazy, and usually more trouble than it was worth. But then somehow the deeper truth slipped across his lips, and he found himself saying, "Actually, it's comforting."
"Comforting?" Lady Lucinda echoed. "What an intriguing choice of word."
He looked past Miss Watson to see her regarding him with curious blue eyes.
"Yes," he said slowly, allowing his thoughts to coalesce before replying, "there is comfort in having a family, I think. It's a sense of just knowing, I suppose."
"What do you mean?" Lucy asked, and she appeared quite sincerely interested.
"I know that they are there," Gregory said, "that should I ever be in trouble or even simply in need of a good conversation, I can always turn to them."
And it was true. He had never really thought about it in so many words, but it was true. He was not as close to his brothers as they were to one another, but that was only natural, given the age difference. When they had been men about town, he had been a student at Eton, and now they were all three married with families of their own. But still, he knew that should he need them, or his sisters for that matter, he had only to ask. He never had, of course. Not for anything important, or even most things unimportant. But he knew that he could. It was more than most men had in this world, more than most men would ever have.
"Mr. Bridgerton?"
He blinked. Lady Lucinda was regarding him quizzically.
"My apologies," he murmured. "Wool gathering, I suppose."
He offered her a smile and a nod, then glanced over at Miss Watson, who, he was surprised to see, had also turned to look at him. Her eyes seemed huge in her face, clear and dazzling green, and for a moment he felt an almost electric connection. She smiled just a little, and with a touch of embarrassment at having been caught, then looked away. Gregory's heart leaped. And then Lady Lucinda spoke again.
"That is exactly how I feel about Hermione," she said. "She is the sister of my heart.
Miss Watson is truly an exceptional lady," Gregory murmured, then added, "as, of course, are you."
"She is a superb watercolorist," Lady Lucinda said.
Hermione blushed prettily.
"Lucy, "But you are," her friend insisted. "Like to paint myself," came Neville Burbrook's jovial voice. "Ruin my shirts every time, though."
Gregory glanced at him in surprise. Between his oddly revealing conversation with Lady Lucinda and his shared glance with Miss Watson,